Hi, how are you doing? There are a lot of lazy comparisons being made between the present situation and 1978, 79, the so-called winter of discontent, because we're heading into obviously the autumn with Christmas not that far away. And for those of us who remember the 70s, this looks as if it might be a similar experience. So the Guardian's Andy Beckett has revisited the 1970s and has explored whether the playing out of the 1978-79 period and the election of the Thatcher government is likely to be repeated. The old saying is that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And for those that remember the 70s, this is looking a bit like the Callaghan government faced with a sea of troubles. It's unlikely that Boris Johnson would return from a Caribbean ministers meeting, having swam in warm waters and allowed. I think it was the Daily Express or the Daily Mail. One of the newspapers paid some what would once have been referred to as a page three stunner, some female about a third of Callaghan's age, to get herself into shot. And appear to be cavorting in the waves with Callaghan in order to get that gotcha picture. And then, of course, the famous Sun headline, Crisis, What Crisis, when Sonny Jim came back. And as one of his advisors said, insisted on being whimsical when he was questioned at Heathrow. I swam. I actually swam. Because he was trying to take the heat out of the whole crisis, but it just played really badly. So people think that the 70s have been repeated. The article by Beckett is designed to explore that, and he says something which is true and has to be said, which is that in the 70s the Callaghan government was betrayed, it was made obvious they were weak. It was made obvious that they couldn't do what they'd been elected to do in 74. There was two elections in 1974, and in the second one, the Wilson government, as it then was elected with a very slim majority, and the promise was that they would lead the trade union bear. They would control the unions, because the unions essentially had began to run the country's overstating it. Although by 78, 79, it began to look like that. But the unions were extremely powerful, and we were still in the era of the block vote. I remember watching. I was interested in politics as a kid, and I remember watching things like the Trade Union Congress and watching Labour leaders appearing before them, and the block vote, union heads holding up a card indicating where their 414,000 votes would go. So it's looking a bit like the 70s, although there are obvious differences. Like, for example, the Callaghan government is widely remembered as being just losing control in the period immediately before the election. They lost control of the economy with inflation. They lost control of industrial policy with the unions turning on them, and they lost control of the parliament when it became impossible to get the SNP to continue voting for them. People like me love to remind the SNP that they put Margaret Thatcher into government by bringing down Jim Callaghan's government. Of course, and maybe I shouldn't admit this, but it was only a very short period of time. The election was going to happen anyway. And the SNP didn't really bring forward by very much the election. Now, Beckett says what a crisis does is it makes it obvious who has power and who was merely thought to have had power. And in that very act, it can change society, because a bit like the Wizard of Oz, people often have power because they're thought to have power, and therefore, like a small dog dominating big dogs in a household, none of them think to actually challenge the small dog's rule. Or an elephant that's tied to a twig, when it's small, will still assume that the twig will restrain it, even when it's large enough to simply walk away. So you can reconfigure society in the aftermath of a crisis, because it becomes. There's a famous saying in the military, which I've probably used before, which is never give an order that you know won't be obeyed, because a lot of your authority is resting on a myth, and it would be very difficult to actually use raw force if authority wasn't enough. So once you've got a good crisis going, and it becomes obvious that people that you thought had raw power merely had something like charismatic authority, then society can change quite dramatically. And maybe we're going through a reconfiguration like that. Beckett thinks that there's big differences between what's happening right now and what happened in the 70s. But in that regard, this business about, you know, recognizing how much power is actually wielded by people, and recognizing that it's less than you'd thought, and that therefore the willingness of people who were previously charmed by their association with power. He mentions the media, he mentions older and mainly male voters, people who love the idea of global Britain and rural Britannia, and Boris showing those foreigners, and Daily Mail stories about licenses for French fishermen not being granted, most licenses being license applications being rejected. And I think I'm right in saying the Jersey fishermen are trying to cause trouble with the French right now, and it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to work out why they're doing it, because they're trying to help the government before the Tory conference next week. If they can generate a few headlines of plucky Brits in the grand tradition of Francis Drake, showing Johnny Foreigner exactly whose herring they are, even if we won't eat them, then that'll play well with the Tory conference. So that there may be that going on. It may be that people are going to learn that global Britain and the kind of headlines that were generated last week by the Australia Britain US deal that excluded the French from the submarine contract and replaced French diesel boats, which I didn't realise, I have to say, that it was the Australians that insisted on them. The French would have sold them with reactors in them, but the Australians insisted that they not be nuclear. But the stories from 10 days ago about that deal, those are exactly the kind of stories that the Telegraph readers and the Daily Mail readers like. And Beckett thinks that if it becomes obvious that in actual fact this is all predicated on a myth of global Britain and British power, then there might be a reconfiguration. So the 70s are meaningfully different, because the Callaghan government really was at the fag end of a bad 5 years, and the trade unions really did have the government on the run. Interestingly, as Beckett says, there wasn't a complete collapse in Labour support. What there was a surge in Conservative support, and particularly in places where it mattered. The voters were prepared to look at the Tory offer, and it wasn't clear that it was going to stick until that tipping point was reached, and suddenly people became conscious of the fact that the public were buying into it. Margaret Thatcher's offer, the Tory Party offer, to confront the unions, and this was played out. One of the reasons why I got an upper second degree and not a first class degree was because I made a complete hash of the very final paper that I sat at university. The 27th of May was a paper called Government and the Economy. And by that point, having sat seven papers, I was shattered. I'd never been that great at government and economy. I was okay at it. And I had to try and get my head around the industrial relations legislation of the 1980s. And I can remember writing the bad answer that I wrote in that paper, because I hadn't really mastered the 80, 82, 84, I think it was, industrial relations legislation. But before the election, the Callaghan government was facing crisis, and Thatcher's pitch began to have purchase, and there was a tipping point reached when people thought, yeah, okay, let's do this. Let's give the person who promises to confront the unions and adopt a completely different approach. Let's give them a chance. Now, Beckett would have us believe that what was rejected in 79 was something that persisted elsewhere. The people on the left love to cite places like Scandinavia or Austria as places where de facto power sharing takes place. The old saying about Labour government in the 70s was beer and sandwiches, which I always note is a really, really bad idea. There is no sandwich filling apart from some meats. But there's no sandwich filling which really goes well with beer. Everything tastes metallic. If you try and eat anything and drink beer, it all tastes like metal. But the old saying was beer and sandwiches. So the trade union bosses would get ushered into Number 10 with the owners of companies, and a deal would be thrashed out between the three bodies, so-called tripartism, or as it's known across the world, corporatism. The idea that government is an arbiter or a broker or a player in a three-way relationship with the workers and the owners of capital. And that supposedly works in Scandinavia and in Austria. And Beckett thinks that it could have worked, it was working to some degree Could have been a model if the UK had been a different kind of society, if there'd been less acrimony, if there'd been no Thatcher government and the smashing of the unions. And he thinks that it's possible that we're seeing the end of what Thatcher managed to establish, which was a superior position for the owners of capital. He says the managers, but he means the owners of capital, the bourgeoisie, the people who get dividends and rent. So he thinks that Thatcher brought in a period that has ran to the present day, where those who hold have the control of the means of production, those who hold the whip hand in the left story, those who have to be challenged and confronted, the sort of the capitalists of comic books, they've had the whip hand for the best part of 30, well, for 40 years. And that might all be changing. So we might be seeing in the driver shortages and in the picker shortages and in the rise in wages and the promise of a £15 minimum wage by some people in the Labour movement. And of course, I think his name was Fletcher, wasn't it, resigning from Labour's shadow team the other day because the party under Starmer was prepared to support it. But Beckett thinks that this might be the beginning of a move back to a more influential position for organised labour and a weaker position for the owners of the means of production. That strong position having been brought in by the changes that Thatcher introduced in the early 80s. Now, what is different, thinks Beckett, is the source of the problems that the Johnson government is, so the source of some of the problems that the Johnson government is experiencing. He thinks it's caused by the strength and by the privileged position they've been placed in, by the way events played out. The 2019 election, of course, was famously get Brexit done, and people in the red wall areas, as they're called, across the northern part of the country, voted because they were sickened of three or four years of parliamentary paralysis, or 3 years of parliamentary paralysis. So they voted to get Brexit done, and what this has done is it's given the government a majority, I think, of about 80. And a weak Labour Party that was divided over the European Union and hasn't managed to unite itself, and it's tearing itself apart this last week at the conference. So it doesn't seem as if Tory mistakes get punished. And Beckett thinks this is causing an attitude which is making things much worse. So this is a government which is afflicted by the problem caused by its own strength. Kirk Douglas, the actor, I think I'm right in saying, had a son who was an accountant, and of course Michael was an actor himself. And Kirk Douglas says something which always stuck with me. He said, "I insisted that my children function, right? I insisted that they function. They could do whatever they liked. They could be a plumber, they could be a joiner, they could be whatever, but they have to function. I've seen too often what happens in this community, these actors' community in Hollywood. I've seen too often what happens when kids get money and have nothing to do all day. And it's not going to happen. This lot are going to function." And the argument is that the Tory government are basically like privileged kids. The reason why Jacob Rees-Mogg can loll all over the benches, the reason why Matt Hancock can behave the way that he does, the reason why money can be spent on failing apps and protective equipment contracts that weren't properly scrutinised, the reason why all of this can get done is precisely because the government doesn't seem to get punished for any of its failings. And this is a government full of people who, if they aren't punished for their failings, will continue to make them and make them at an increasing rate. So that the problems of this government aren't problems of a lack of control. They're problems of no control being placed on them. It's not the situation that Callaghan faced, where he couldn't control the unions. Johnson's problem is that nobody controls him. Of course, that, of course, is what Carrie said in their famous row that was reported to the police. They were arguing because Boris was trying to stuff himself with a tube of Pringles while drinking a bottle of red wine or whatever, and managed to slosh some of it on the sofa. And I think she did that classic thing. This is why we can't have nice things, because you're like a bloody bear, you know. So Boris's problem is that nobody says no to Boris, and this is a problem that's spread through the government. And it thinks Beckett thinks this is exactly why we're getting the shambles that we're getting, because there doesn't seem to be a downside to it. Unless there's some negative consequences visited in them personally, then they won't worry about the negative consequences visited in the country. The newspapers quite like the whole shtick as well, and they spend more time concentrating on Labour's weaknesses and divisions than they do on the government's behaviour. And it's because the press has always been right wing. A stock part of a politics education is running through the newspapers and working out which are on the right and which are on the left. And of course, the only two that were ever consistently on the left were the Mirror Group, Mirror and the Daily Record in Scotland, and leaving aside the Morning Star as being an irrelevance, the Guardian is on the left for the middle classes. But all the other papers are centre-right, and some of them extremely right-wing, like the Daily Mail. Even when the Sun supported Labour, it supported Labour as a centrist party. So when they switched to Blair, it was only because Blair had already switched to them. So the press quite like the sort of swaggering bravado of the Johnson government, and they dislike everything that especially a Labour Party, which is in the grip of a crisis over identity politics and gender, with David Lammy talking about cervix transplants and Rachel Reeve unable to say whether women have a cervix and spending 40 seconds panting over it. There was an interesting remark made this morning. Someone said, if you watched it on the London radio broadcast, it was bad, but it was bearable, because you could see her doing her ventilating, vaporing shtick. You could see her throwing her arms around and looking exasperated. But if you listened to it, it was something completely different. You couldn't work out what was going on. All you heard was somebody panting on the radio. So a Labour Party that's making it so easy for the Daily Mail and the other right-wing papers to portray them as just completely out of touch with how ordinary people live and think, like a lecturer in trade union studies in the college that Corbyn failed. You know, if you make it easy for the papers to do that kind of thing, then they'll do it. Could government fall into Starmer's lap in the way that some would say it did Thatcher's lap in 79? Well, the problem is that Starmer isn't faced with somebody as weak as Callaghan was, so it's not the case that Johnson's in quite the predicament that Callaghan was in. So that's probably not going to happen. And what's more likely to happen, thinks Beckett, is that you'll end up with two weak parties. And given that Britain's two-party politics, somebody has to win. So, and also there's a boundary review. Beckett doesn't say this, but it's a big thing among Tories, this boundary review coming up, which is going to gift the party. John Curtis says maybe 6, 10, other people say 13, but the boundary review is going to gift the Tory party a number of seats, and in a tight election that can make the difference. So what you could get is two weak parties, and one of the weak parties, the Conservatives, winning the next election regardless. And while that might be in some ways better for the country and that it'll focus the minds of the Tory government, it might be a lot less reassuring for people, because they'll begin to understand just the state that we're in. One of the problems with comparing the UK to other countries is that, and I certainly remember this in the 1970s, and it's certainly true of Corbyn's Labour Party and John McDonnell, there's an acceptance of the legitimacy of returns to capital. In other words, if somebody gives up some of their present possible consumption, I make no bones about it, I own a few shares. And the reason why I own shares is because I could have bought things and didn't. I bought companies instead. I bought plant machinery rather than racing bikes and holidays in the Maldives. So I could have bought, a holiday abroad, or alternatively, I could have bought somebody a machine in the north of England, which they can use to have a living to make things. And the idea that I'm entitled to nothing extra in the future by giving up the holiday, because we all live finite lives, we're all going to die. And you could die before you've had a chance to spend your money. And indeed, that's what people typically say. You've got to spend it while you've got it. You don't know how long you've got. You can't take it with you. Now, of course, there are people who buy investments and don't buy holidays abroad with their kids. They don't take their kids to Disneyland, and instead they invest for the future. And then they die, and they never had that holiday with their kids in Disneyland, which is exactly why most people go to Disneyland and don't buy the property. They don't buy the asset that would give somebody else a job. So a society has got an interest in making it possible for people who are prepared to take the chance that they'll die before they see any rewards, to take that chance and see the rewards, to get the 4.5-5% that investment typically gives you in the very long run. Now, one of the reasons why we were in such trouble in the 1970s is because as the first industrial nation and as the country that played host to Marx as he sat in the British Library writing his theory, as the country with huge numbers of universities, with left-leaning academics teaching young people not how to think but what to think, in that country, by the 1970s, we'd got us into a position where we were using public money to sponsor what I would consider to be, if not sedition, bloody close to sedition. And the old gag is that the only battle honour of the Royal Army Educational Corps was the 1945 Labour victory, because people on the left are university educated, stuff folks' heads full of nonsense. And so the idea that we can just be Norway or Sweden or Austria, because these countries are apparently corporatist, if they can do it, why can't we? Well, there's a very simple reason, which is we don't see the owning plant is legitimate. We don't see that having a return for owning plant is legitimate. We don't see that employers, just like everybody else, are price takers rather than price setters. We don't see that if workers want to get paid more money, they have to increase their marginal product, which is work more efficiently or become more skillful or do something else, and you will get paid what you're worth. None of those beliefs are in place in the UK. They never have been. Thatcher, as I've said before, got elected in 1979 because people were broken, not because they thought she was right. They were desperate. They were prepared to try anything. Like somebody plunging downhill in a JCB digger faced with an infinity of levers to pull and things to push. You're going to start pushing and pulling the levers because you've got certain death regardless, so you might as well try something. That was 1979. That was trying something. But there's never been an acceptance that if you give up some of your present consumption to buy somebody else a machine that they can use, you're actually entitled to the rent. You're entitled to the receipt that they owe you. You're entitled to the share of the enhanced productivity that your investment gives them. If somebody's running, if you make it a micro example, people can see it. If somebody's running a business with a bad van and you rent them a good van that improves their productivity and they pay you and they're happy to pay you because they're making more money for themselves, people see that's legitimate and you should pay the rent on the van. That's what business is. Business is giving a worker a better van so they can actually make a better living than they could do doing something without the plant machinery. But folk don't see that. So the failure of a corporatist model, the failure of a proper social democratic model in the UK is the failure of socialism. It's not the failure of socialism to realise itself in practical politics. It's the failure of socialism in telling people things that are inspired by socialist theory, which are false. And on the basis of those false beliefs, ordinary people establish political parties and vote for people like Jeremy Corbyn, and it's all nonsense. And if for the sake of argument, we head back into the 1970s and an attempt to make use of the map that the Marxists and the quasi-Marxists provide of the world. If we do that, we'll discover what we discovered before, which is it's a bad map that leads nowhere. And then we'll end up favouring another Thatcher after another 20 years in the wilderness, not because we think that she's a good cartographer and has the right map, but just because we're desperate. And this is no way to run a railway, but we keep returning to it. There's chaos. And if you look back to earlier political theorists, they anticipated this. You know, you don't have to look back as far as Plato, but it's interesting that Plato pretty much saw what democratic men would do. But if you look even back at John Stuart Mill, John Stuart Mill predicted with uncanny accuracy exactly what would happen when we had a mass democracy. And there's very little evidence that we can get out of it. And indeed, thinking about it, Mill might have been a better commentator on Britain than he was on the world generally, because other countries have managed to actually inculcate in the people a broad understanding of the free enterprise system. So mass democracy in America before Bernie Sanders had ordinary people understanding what marginal product theory implied about returns to labour. Thinking about it, in actual fact, it's an interesting, when you say something out loud, it's interesting how pennies drop. You wonder whether most of the young Americans who joined the enterprise societies and the schools from a left-wing point of view, were indoctrinated into a lot of bad economic theory and bad industrial theory. You wonder how many of them really understood that with the spread of trade and with no barriers to the free movement of goods and services, all of the skilled workers, all of the workers with their hands, would see their wages collapse. And it was the election of Trump in 2016 that, again, just like the election of Thatcher in 1979, was the reaction to that. It wasn't, thinking about it, I wonder, there's an interesting thesis. I wonder whether the workers who ostensibly were signing up for economic liberalism, free enterprise theory, you wonder whether they really were, whether they really understood that NAFTA and free trade across the board and the industrialization of China would imply that all of these workers in the northeast of the United States would lose their manufacturing jobs. I wonder if they ever knew that was implied in the theory that they so enthusiastically adopted, or whether it was the case that getting paid better wages than school teachers for relatively unskilled jobs was something that they enjoyed enormously and grabbed the ideological justification for that without ever really understanding it. The government probably has been insulated from a lot of blame. Looking at the headlines, I don't think they've been insulated from blame by the papers. It's just that it has no part just with the public. And there's a very obvious reason for that. And it Guardian journalists need to take a good hard look at themselves when it comes to the reckless empowerment of the Johnson government. The most obvious reason why Johnson and others can do what they like and the public don't really blame them and see Boris, as they always call him, as one of the lads, is precisely because they were utterly sickened by the shenanigans of the Labour Party MPs and people like Gina Miller, who was looking back now, I see she's forming a political party, but people like Gina Miller, who were a front for loads of other vested interests, and the attempt by the Labour Party to play fast and loose with the 2016 vote just disgusted a lot of people. And the reason why Johnson can do as he pleases is because the self-defined progressives who tried to frustrate the Brexit process really didn't understand just how angry people were getting. And when you look at, from a Scottish point of view, you look at the SNP refusing to support any deal at all, effectively voting for a no-deal Brexit, they've managed to get away with that because it's all been lost in the noise generally over Brexit. But there's not much doubt that the Johnson government was a beneficiary of the popular frustration that was caused by the Brexit process. So when Beckett talks about the easy ride that the Tory party get from the media, from the paper specifically rather than the broadcast media, there's a reason for that, and it's because the behaviour of, for example, the Liberal Democrats, for Swinson to actually suggest that Parliament could just reverse the Brexit votes and we would pretend it didn't happen. She, of course, lost her seat for that. But to have so little self-awareness that you would actually dare to suggest such a thing and imagine that the public would wear it, that's exactly the mentality that produced the 2019 Tory victory. Because ordinary folk take a very, very democratic view. If you have a vote, you can't escape the consequences. And if you try to, the very act of trying to will destroy you. To say that Thatcher gave the employers the upper hand for a period of 40 or 50 years, and we're now, 40 years, I suppose, and we're now coming to the end of that. The thing that people miss is that it wasn't that she simply declared something and then the results were modest. It's that she declared something and people disbelieved her, and she had to sack all the wets in her own party, the so-called wets, the people who challenged her. Thatcher was quite vulnerable for the first term, and people always cite the Falklands factor, the victory in the Falklands as being the thing that won the 1983 election. Thatcher was quite vulnerable. She sacked a lot of people who were much more emollient and classical One Nation Tories than she was. It wasn't impossible that she could have fallen, but the thing that made the difference was the policies actually worked. Patrick Minford, the Brexit economist that everyone cites, the one economist essentially who was the go-to man when it came to providing economic arguments against remaining in the EU. People younger people than me won't remember that Minford was the one person that backed the hard-faced Thatcher reforms of the 1980s, the so-called freeing up of the supply side of the economy, taking away pricing power from workers and giving it to the free market. Not giving it to the employers, giving it to the free market. And 364 economists wrote to the Times saying that Minford was wrong and the policy was wrong. And Minford essentially stood alone, and he was right. And this is what people forget. People forget that people like Patrick Minford and Friedrich Hayek and others said that workers will always get paid what they're worth. Skilled workers will get paid more money. A skill is going to be defined as something that can't be replicated by a machine, the cost of which is greater than the cost of the worker. So when you're doing something that they can't actually do with a machine, for example, polishing a table, a French polished table. If there's no way of doing that, or the machine that does it costs £600,000 and the cost of capital is 8%, then the worker's going to get paid. If the table will sell for a high price, the worker will get paid high wages, and everybody gets paid their marginal product. If you're being underpaid, and the example I always give is standing in an accountancy firm in 1989, listening to the accountants baiting the owner of the company for higher wages, telling each other, but really telling him who was standing 2 feet away, that one of them had been to a presentation by another accountancy firm and talking about the wages and the car that they were being offered. Because the person that owned the means of production, the person that owned the office, had no power, because the people who were making the money were the accountants, and everyone knew it. So if you own a machine which delivers all the productivity, and someone is an unskilled worker using that machine, then you can be absolutely certain that the returns will go to the person that owns the machine. If, on the other hand, you own machinery that is anyone could have, for example, picks and shovels in a landscaping business, then skilled landscape workers will get paid their marginal product, because if you don't give them the £22 an hour that you have to give them to stop them setting up on their own, you're charging them out effectively at £25 an hour. You're making £3, and for that £3, you organise the system of work, you store the tools. You advertise and you do all the other things that managers do. But try paying them £18 an hour when they know you're getting 25 for their time, and they buy a van and set themselves up as landscapers. So you get paid what you're worth. Thatcher said that was true, and that employers don't get to set wages, and that underpaid workers move to other employers and get paid more, and that the returns in capital fall to the average of 5% where they've always been. Thatcher said that, and nobody really understood it, but she was right. So by the middle of the 1980s, you had a jobs boom. The economy was going at the shows, and people were finding that even though they weren't members of a union, they were not being driven down to the rate of reproduction that the Marxists would suggest. So it wasn't just that Thatcher postulated something and won an election. She postulated something that turned out to be true, and that was why she won election after election. And as I say, the present travails of the Tory Party are quite different from the position that the Labour Party was in 1979, because in 1979 the Labour Party was in a position where not just Labour but the Tories as well had proceeded on the basis that incomes policies made some kind of sense, and they didn't. I always quote Enoch Powell because he said it early, and he was right, and people always object to you quoting Enoch Powell because they think that if you say he was right about one thing, you're saying he was right about everything. He wasn't. But Powell said that early on, he said that you can let employers set any prices they like for labour. You can allow the trade unions to force the employers to set high prices for products. They just won't be able to sell them. Inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. The only downside to letting trade unionists offer violence to other workers and prevent workers doing jobs that they would like to do at wage rates they consider attractive, and thereby forcing low profits on employer on owners of capital, forcing them to wish they'd never invested. The downside to that is in the medium term, because nobody else will invest. If the state can't stop workers threatening other workers or prospective workers, if the state can't do that and refuses to, then your country becomes uninvestable, and people will not give you £1 billion worth of car plant because they don't anticipate ever being able to get any benefit out of it, so the car plant goes somewhere else. So the real downside to organised labour comes in unemployment and underinvestment and despair and destruction. It doesn't come in inflation. The idea that you have to have an incomes policy in order to control the inflation. Inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. So you can let the workers' price themselves out of jobs if you like. You can let them destroy their children's and their grandchildren's lives if you like. It's unwise to do so. You should stop them offering violence. You should allow picket lines to form and people to make arguments, but for workers to go to work if they want to. But if you don't do that, if you allow the trade unionists to be simple thugs and stand outside a place and refuse to let other people work for wages they consider attractive, all you'll do is cause walkaway in employers or the owners of the means of production, more accurately. It won't serve their interest to invest, so they'll allow the place to go to rack and ruin because they can't move the plant machinery, and it makes no sense to deploy more capital given that you don't get any returns from it. So you allow the thing to run into the ground and you walk away from it and you accept your losses. And that's exactly what happened in, for example, the industrial northeast of the United States. It just wasn't worth investing in car plants and steel plants because you don't make any money out of it. You're as well cutting your losses. So, as I say, Thatcher didn't triumph just because of some, you know, labour failure. She triumphed because people saw that she was right. Just to conclude, there is an issue in democratic politics when it comes to the difference between what you can sell and what you can do. As I've said before, the famous remark in politics is, I think it was Peter Mandelson maybe, he said, if you're explaining, you're losing. So you never want to put yourself in a position where you haven't used many sentences to explain your position. When Ed Miliband was asked in 2015, do you accept that you spent too much money when you were in government? And that was the key question, and he should have prepared for it. And I have got quite a lot of sympathy for the position he was in, because even now, I'm not sure Ed Miliband could have responsibly given a different answer to the one he gave, which was no. The problems that were caused 2007, 2008 with the banking collapses were caused by a failure in bank regulation, and in particular a failure of bank regulation in the United States, but in the UK as well. And massive property bubbles were allowed to be created by ridiculous lending. And then it was a question of let the banks be nationalised, which I would have done, or bail them out with public money, which is what they did. And the problem wasn't caused. There's two things. The national accounts are not the same as the household accounts. That's true. That's a classic statement of the left. And it's accurate. My spending is your income. Your spending is my income. So when the economy goes to hell in a handcart, the government should not cut its spending as well. So the national accounts are not the same as household accounts. And the problems caused after 2007 were not caused by massive spending. The budget in 2009, I think, had $175 billion deficit, which was, in real terms, probably today's money, probably $210, $215. So Sunak spent $400 billion on COVID. So even in 2009, we were spending well over half the COVID spend just on counter-cyclical spending caused by the crash. Government has to keep spending as the tax revenues collapse and as welfare claims increase. So when Miliband was asked in 2015 whether Labour had overspent, and he said no, in a sense he was right. They were overspending by 40 billion when the economy was in an upswing. They shouldn't have done that. So from 2004 onwards, there was a mild deficit, which was probably a bad idea given how strong the tax receipts were. But basically, the problems were caused by a failure to regulate the banks. And you can't get elected doing that. In 2015, they couldn't win the election because they couldn't actually, in one sentence, articulate something in the way that, for example, in 2019, Get Brexit Done, in three words, articulate something. So there's what you need to say to get elected, and then there's what you can do once you're elected. And the great thing is, if the things that you do once you're elected require explanations to criticise them, but that have got the great strength of being defensible and good on their face, then that's the kind of thing you can get away with in government. So if you think about Gordon Brown and the Labour Party, 1997-2010, they got elected on education, education, education. Keir Starmer, in a homage to Blair in his speech as leader at the conference, I think yesterday, he said, the most important thing is education. I'm tempted to say it three times. That was a Peter Mandelson joke. That was designed, apparently, that was designed to reference Blair, and I think it was a suggestion by Mandelson, who's been scuttling about the conference. And of course, everyone recognised the joke and they all laughed. So education, 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 tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, no tax rises for the first term of a Labour government. Now, those were the things that they got elected on. And in 2001, it was essentially seconds. We're going to do more of this. So they got elected. But what they actually did were things like, for example, bringing in an in-work welfare system, which hugely advantaged unskilled part-time work, unskilled, enjoyable part-time work near where you live. Now, for the best part of 20 years, the Tory party has found it impossible to attack that, because it's really difficult to say that you want to force single parents to do more hours at work. Even now saying it, as I say it, I can see how difficult it is to say that. Marcus Rashford has his school meals campaign. Very, very difficult to find a way to attack that, because on the face of it, it's good. Making an argument about long-term responsibilities of parents and infantilizing of people in difficult circumstances, thereby making things worse in the long run for them, for their kids, and for everybody else. Very difficult argument to make. They're resisting for the moment Rashford's objections to the cut in universal credit. Sunak and Johnson obviously think they're strong enough to go through with this cut that kicks in, I think, next week in universal credit, the withdrawal of the £20 extraordinary payment. But by and large, you can get elected on slogans and then do things which weren't in your manifestos or certainly weren't cashed out. I think the original claim was that tax credits would cost £1 billion. They very, very quickly cost £30 billion. So you can get elected on slogans, and then you can do things that were really big changes for society, and expect to get away with it and force the next incoming government, even if you lose the election, to continue in the same vein. You can do that as long as the thing that you did is easy to explain in its upside and hard to explain in its downside. And one of the sort of real strengths of the Johnson government is that it's got enough latitude to be able to do things like, for example, go through with the universal credit cut, because Labour's so weak that you don't have to make a complicated argument about work incentives and the impact that they'll have on kids over a 20 or 30 year time frame. They're actually able to do that. They're able to go through with the Northern Ireland Protocol and continue suffering the bad feelings in Northern Ireland because they've got the majority and they don't rely on the DUP. So it's the problem the Labour Party's got right now is, how do you have a slogan that gets you elected, even if your intention is to do something quite different in government? Owen Jones is in The Guardian this morning saying that Keir Starmer's fundamental problem is dishonesty, and now he has to go because he can't be tolerated. If you have a dishonest leader, then they corrupt politics and they cause people to completely disengage. And Starmer stood with his arm around, I think Corbyn claims, Jones, I don't remember, but he claims that he stood with Corbyn and said that the 2019 manifesto would be a platform. And that hasn't been the case. And therefore, Starmer needs to go. Now, the prospects for a Labour victory depend on them crystallising the alternative to the Johnson government in slogans in the way that Blair did in 1997. And at the moment, it's very difficult to see how that can be done, because Johnson just sprawls across the middle ground in British politics. The Labour Party can't risk revisiting the EU issue. They can't plausibly make claims about the size of the public sector, because Johnson's hugely hostile to any of the kind of cuts that maybe Cameron and Nick Clegg would have tolerated. So it's hard to see where they can actually claim running room. But what they are going to be gifted, if things don't change soon, is exactly the running room that Thatcher was gifted in 78, 79. Because when you've got 26.8% inflation, which was a couple of years before that, and you've got a winter of discontent, then you can win because you've just been gifted propitious circumstances. And it's almost impossible to lose as long as you seem modestly competent. And I was shaken a little bit yesterday when I saw that Bloomberg were talking about the pound sterling having idiosyncratic risk. In other words, if you're running a functioning currency in a bog standard, modern, progressive, industrialised, liberal, democratic country, then you would expect a small increase in interest rates to cause your inflation problems to disappear, and you can trim the sails and keep everything on an even keel. That doesn't work when you have a failing currency. If you're Argentina and you're running whatever, a peso or Venezuela, I think a bolivar, if you're running a currency like that, nobody will buy $1 billion worth of your currency. Nobody will. I don't know if the peso at some point was 30 to the dollar. If you've got $1 billion, you're not going to buy 30 billion of peso and then take a 7% interest rate, even if the bonds, the dollar bonds, pay 1%. That 6% spread will be nothing like enough compensation if you think the peso is going to really collapse. And therefore, when you turn your 30 billion pesos back into dollars, you might only get $50 million, never mind a billion. So once you've got the possibility of a failed economy and so-called idiosyncratic risk, it becomes really difficult to get a grip of a falling currency and rising inflation, because people don't respond to small amounts of interest rate trimming with purchases of your currency and your bonds. And Bloomberg suggested that the pound is becoming decoupled from the dollar. Dollar strength is surprising. You would have thought, given all the trouble in the United States, that the dollar would be weaker, but it's not. But the pound is looking as if it's decoupling from the dollar. So Keir Starmer and the Labour Party will win if a calamity descends on the Tory party in the way that it did the Labour Party in the late 70s. If we end up with 5 or 6% interest rates and a need to roll over £80 billion worth of debt every year, thereby loading another £4 billion in tax rises onto the taxpayer every year as the debt matures and is rolled over. If that happens, then the Labour Party will win, because what they'll say is no more boom and bust, prudence with a purpose, a stable country with a prosperous future. You can make up the slogans right now and it would be so easy. So that they're not going to win the next election by offering specifics, because Johnson, with Rishi Sunak writing the checks, has been able to offer nearly every specific. And in the few occasions when he stood up, when Sunak has managed to persuade Johnson that something difficult needs to be done, it's not been anything very big, and it's not been the kind of thing that would annoy too many Tory voters. The dividend tax rises that they brought in to try and fund social care are irritating, but the judgment is that the Reform Party doesn't constitute somewhere that discontented Tories can go. But the trouble will start when the broad middle class suddenly realise that the economy is in crisis and that Britain is starting to head back into something approximate the 1970s, albeit for different reasons. Trade union power was the problem in the 1970s, and workers using the exclusion of possible workers to raise prices, and then government running lax monetary policy in order to try and disguise what was going on, essentially trying to price the workers back into their real jobs by devaluing the currency. And that, as I say, produced a calamity in 79. The calamity that could be produced right now is one that's baked into the present amount of debt, and all we need now is a collapse in the confidence of bond investors in the future of the UK, and a dumping of British denominated debt and the British pound to buy other currencies. And that could easily spike us up to 5% bond yields. And if that happens, the keys to number 10 will be handed to Keir Starmer. Not because we think that he's any good, but because we think, just like Jim Callaghan compared to Margaret Thatcher, the other guy is no good at all. Peace.